Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. This is your co-host, Shahnaz Haqqani. In today's new episode, we speak with Sean Roberts about his brand new book, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority, published with Princeton in 2020. Roberts is the director of the International Development Studies Program at George Washington University. He received his PhD in cultural anthropology from the University of Southern California and has been studying the Uyghurs, a Muslim ethnic minority, for some 30 years, including for his master's and PhD thesis research. In this book, Roberts argues that China's violent campaign against the Uyghur Muslim population is linked to the broader U.S.-led global war on terror, showing that China appropriates the message of the language of the war on terror as justification for persecuting this ethnic minority. Roberts provides a detailed historical account of the current crisis, of China's settler colonialism in the Uyghur homeland, and of the ways that China relies heavily on the war on terror, on the U.S.-led global war on terror, to imagine Uyghurs as its enemy. In today's discussion, Roberts addresses questions about who the Uyghurs are and what their relationship with China has been like historically, how China's systematic campaign to erase Uyghur identity and culture is linked to the global war on terror, the idea of self-fulfilling prophecies and how it contextualizes Uyghur responses to China's violent policies, some suggestions for responding to this human tragedy, and his own experiences meeting and talking with Uyghurs and doing this research. The book will appeal to anyone interested in the discourse on the war on terror and terrorism, Islam and Muslims in China, genocide studies, Chinese studies, history, and generally anyone who wants to better understand what's happening with the Uyghurs. Here's my interview with Sean Roberts. Hi, Sean. Thank you so much for willing to join me today to talk about your fantastic book, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority. I really enjoyed reading the book. I was brand new to this. This is not my area of expertise by any means, but I was interested in it intellectually and otherwise. I wanted to learn what was happening and also see what I could do about it as a person, as an individual, as a scholar. So thank you for joining me today and also for writing this fantastic book.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to the podcast.
So we like to begin this podcast. We have a tradition here to begin the podcast by asking our guests if they could tell us about their intellectual journey, how they got to their chosen field, what brought them here. So could you please tell us about your intellectual journey?
Sure. I started in college back in the 1980s, being interested in communism and Marxism. And I went to Yugoslavia in 1987 as an exchange student and found out that people in Yugoslavia weren't interested in communism or Marxism anymore. But I discovered nationalism and Islam at that time as being critical issues in Yugoslavia. And this was before the war, of course. And when I returned to college, I decided to start studying the Muslim people of the Soviet Union. I was able to go to Uzbekistan, then the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic, in 1989-90, and discovered that most of that which had been written about the Muslims of the Soviet Union was largely off base. It had mostly talked about the Muslims of the Soviet Union having a rising nationalism that was targeted against the Soviet state, that there was significant tensions between Russians and Muslim nationalities in the Soviet Union. And I found that generally not to be true. You know, there were certain tensions, but no more than racial or ethnic tensions in the U.S., and probably a lot less to some degree. But then I went during my winter break across to China, and there I found that the Uyghur people, who are very closely related to the Uzbek people, both linguistically and culturally, that they had serious issues with Chinese rule. And that, so from that point onward in the early 1990, I decided that I would study Uyghurs.
Wow. And tell us about this book in particular. What inspired it? And I know you've been working on this for 25 years, is it? So how did this book come about?
Sure. Well, yeah, this the book initially was going to be a critical examination of the question of whether China faced a terrorist threat from among its Uyghur population, which is something I've been looking at for quite some time. And I started doing research in 2016 on this issue and started kind of formulating the focus of my book. But then events really overtook the project, and I really had to address what has happened since 2017. And it kind of organically came together that the two questions, the one I was originally looking at, the salience of the idea that there was a Uyghur terrorist threat and what had happened since 2017 were quite interrelated. And so as a result, kind of the form of the book changed, but a lot of the research I had already done was appropriate to the new form of the book.
Yeah, I'm really interested in your methodology because there's, you know, you occasionally talk about ethnographic research, having interviewed Uyghurs. I'm pronouncing it as Uyghurs. How do you pronounce it?
Uyghur.
Uyghur. Okay. The historical account is incredibly helpful in situating what's happening and contextualizing what's happening. So we'll come back to the question of especially the ethnographic accounts. I would love to hear some more about your experiences in, finding people to interview and your visits to these places and these communities. That would be fantastic. Can you give, and I don't imagine a lot of our readers to be necessarily very familiar with what's happening. So could you give us a rough idea, a very general idea of who the Uyghurs are? Where they're located, maybe some key actors in the story of their current history.
Sure. Well, first of all, the Uyghurs are a Turkic people. Their language is from the Turkish language family. The language is pretty much mutually intelligible with Uzbek. Less so with Turkish, but you can certainly find the commonalities. They number about 11 million in the area of northwest China that they consider their homeland. That is officially called the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China. However, they've always had a very tenuous relationship with modern Chinese states. And I talk about this in my first chapter, which is kind of a historical overview of that relationship up to 2000. The Qing dynasty initially conquered this region in the mid 18th century. And from that point onward, it had it kind of maintained the region more as a frontier buffer zone. In the late 19th century, it tried to integrate the region more into the Chinese Empire as an actual province. And that was the first time you really saw a significant attempt to assimilate Uyghurs to Chinese culture, to Han culture. During the nationalist period of Chinese rule, the area remained very tenuously connected to the Chinese state. It was basically run by local Han administrators who themselves didn't really have close contacts with the central government. And in fact, at one point, the administrator in the region in the 1930s was actually probably closer tied to the Soviet Communist Party and Moscow than he was to the Chinese nationalist government in Nanjing. So it's only in 1949, when the Communist Revolution happens in China, that there's more of an attempt to integrate this into a modern, this region that the Uyghurs consider their homeland, into a modern Chinese state. And I argue in my book that for the first three decades, the Chinese Communist Party was only able to do that partially. And that was in part due to a lack of capacity. This was still a far-flung region. Also, during that period, China kind of positioned itself as an isolationist state. It was looking at this region as important to keeping out possible threats from the West and Southwest. Also, there was, you know, a lot of chaos happening with the Cultural Revolution and before that, the Great Leap Forward. And as a result, you don't really see the region significantly integrated into the People's Republic of China until the 1980s and 1990s. Prior to that, there was a significant demographic shift. The Chinese government sent a lot of Han to settle the region, but they mostly settled in the north of the region, which had transportation links to China proper. And the south of the region remained significantly Uyghur in character and overwhelmingly Uyghur demographically. And so a lot of, you know, my research kind of starts at that point in the 1990s, and there was tension between Uyghurs and the Chinese state. Initially in the 80s, the Chinese state instituted a lot of reforms. They allowed for kind of a cultural renaissance in the Uyghur region. There was a lot of Uyghur publications coming out. They allowed Uyghurs to open up mosques. They allowed Uyghurs to establish religious practice again. And then that started to erode by the end of the 1980s, you know, and that in part is a story of China's change after the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989. You started to see the Chinese government be less open to reforms that had anything to do with allowing citizens more voice or anything to do with kind of a democratization or diversification, let's say. And also with the fall of the Soviet Union, Uyghurs started looking across the border and saying, well, gee, there is an independent Kazakhstan now, there's an independent Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and so on. Why is there not an independent Uyghur state? And might the People's Republic of China fall apart just like the Soviet Union? And at the same time, the Chinese government was looking at that same issue and was increasingly concerned about its different ethnic minority areas, including both the Uyghur region, the Tibetan region, and even the Mongolian region. So you started to have campaigns against any expressions of Uyghur self-determination, and that was characterized as separatism. And then I think that really, the thing that really changed the relationship was after 9/11, in the declaration of the war on terror, the Chinese government started to shift its interpretation of Uyghur disloyalty from separatism to terrorism. And that really allowed the Chinese government to increase its repression in the region with impunity from the international community, because the international community essentially endorsed the idea of suspending human rights when it came to fighting terrorism.
Oh, that's excellent, actually, because my next question is precisely about this idea of the global war on terror and its connection with the Uyghur situation. So you make an important and I think a very convincing argument in this book connecting this crisis to two important issues or phenomena. So one is the larger global war on terror, and the other is settler colonialism. Now, I don't imagine that a lot of people are familiar. I hadn't thought of this way at all, but then again, I'm so new to this conversation. So I was wondering if you, and the book does this really excellently. So I was wondering if you could describe briefly for us this relationship to our listeners. So we can do this in a set of two questions. First, we can talk about the global war on terror and when it and what it has to do with what's happening in China at all, and then or what the Republic of China is doing to the Uyghurs. And then the second question I'll ask it after, but we can talk about the how this is a form of settler colonialism.
Yeah. I think essentially, you know, I make the argument. Not to preempt your second question, but I make the argument throughout the book that what the Chinese state is most interested in terms of the Uyghur region and the Uyghur people relates to settler colonization of the region, the Uyghurs' homeland, essentially. But as I mentioned, you know, in the 1990s, the Chinese government framed any suppression of Uyghur political voices as being a campaign against separatism and promoting the idea of the unity of the Chinese state. After 2001, this really began to, it changed almost on a dime. It changed very quickly. The Chinese government immediately after 9/11 started a campaign pushing to have the international community recognize the Uyghurs as a significant terrorist threat in the context of the global war on terror. And in doing so, I describe this in a whole chapter in the book. The Chinese government tries to portray all Uyghur political actors around the world as being linked to Al-Qaeda and international Islamic terrorism. And this is really a laughable accusation, because so many of the groups they mention in some of these documents are very much secular political organizations, and they're mostly located in the West, in Germany, in Europe, and in the U.S., that have been fighting for some time for Uyghur human rights. And however, they do mention in their documents one group in Afghanistan that when they first brought up this group, I don't think any researchers outside of China or probably even inside China had ever heard of this group. It was called the Eastern Turkestan Islamic Movement. And initially, Western states pushed back on the idea that this group should be recognized as a terrorist organization. But gradually, the U.S. Changed its policy and essentially recognized this group as a terrorist organization and helped the Chinese government get it listed on the UN Security Council's consolidated list of terrorist groups. And there's not really a smoking gun for the reason in this change in policy in the U.S., but most observers at the time, and I'm quite convinced of this myself, feel that it was more or less a quid pro quo decision by the U.S. to get China's acquiescence in the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So the U.S. was already in the summer of 2002 starting to think about how it would link Iraq to the global war on terror. And one of the big hurdles it faced was the UN Security Council and making sure that China would not, I think both China and Russia would not oppose the U.S. Invading Iraq. And this, in some ways, I think changed a lot for Uyghurs around the world. This group, which I've done research on, barely existed as an organization. I found very little evidence that it had any connections to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, as the Chinese state asserted. In fact, my research suggested that the Taliban ensured that this group was inactive and could not pose a threat to China, which was something that they guaranteed the Chinese diplomats at the time in exchange for increased relations with the Chinese state. So despite that, despite the group almost being non-existent and certainly being inconsequential both to China and the world, it set in motion a whole series of things that have affected Uyghurs ever since. Many Uyghur human rights activists in the West were put on terrorist lists and given Interpol red notices as a result of this, because the Chinese state said, well, these people are connected to ETIM. And even though that there was no evidence of them being connected to ETIM, as you're probably well aware, after 9/11, people who got put on lists like this suffered consequences for many years and could not get themselves off the lists, regardless of whether it was legitimate or not that they were put on a list. And in addition, it created a situation where the Chinese state could claim that there was potentially a terrorist threat inside the Uyghur population, which is something I think certainly did not exist at the time and almost never has existed. And as a result, they were able to attack the Uyghur population as a whole. You know, they're able to kind of racially and ethnically profile Uyghurs as potentially dangerous, put Uyghurs under increased surveillance and scrutiny. And this led to, I think, an escalation of aggressive policies against Uyghurs throughout the 2000s that eventually created more and more conflict going forward. And today, as the Chinese state is essentially implementing what I suggest is cultural genocide against the Uyghurs, there once again, the Chinese state is justifying this as a counterterrorism measure.
Yeah. Yeah, my next question is going to be, do you want to talk about the settler colonialism as well?
Sure. I mean, I think that one point that is critical, you know, for a long time, scholarship has been reticent to talk about any kind of colonialism other than European colonialism. I think that has changed over the last, you know, decade plus. There's a recognition that colonialism has been a feature of history constantly. And it has not only been something perpetrated by Western states, by European states, it's also been perpetrated by Asian states, by states throughout the world at different time periods. And I think it's important to view the Uyghur situation and its connection and its relationship with the modern Chinese states as a colonial relationship. As I mentioned earlier, the Chinese state, well, the Qing dynasty, the precursor to modern Chinese states, conquered this region, essentially occupied it. And increasingly, there's been an attempt, particularly since the late 19th century, to settle the region with Han settlers and to really make this an integral part of modern China and almost a generic part of modern China where Uyghur characteristics are not so pronounced. And, you know, this is something we've seen historically in all over the world where states seek to usurp territory and push out the indigenous population, usually displacing the population, breaking down its identity, and in some cases, quarantining them. You know, I mean, you could look at the story of the Native Americans, particularly in the West, as the United States expanded. Also, the story of indigenous people in Latin America, but also, you know, people in Siberia and people in Western China who've been overwhelmed by invading states that have wanted to settle the land. And I think one of the interesting characteristics of settler colonialism versus other forms of colonialism is the population that is in the region becomes unimportant and actually becomes a barrier to the state's goals of settling the region. Other forms of colonialism, states prefer to exploit the indigenous population because the states aren't seeking to essentially take over that territory indefinitely. So I think that's really part of why you see what's happening now to the Uyghurs in their homeland is very much about the Chinese government trying to remove this population as a barrier to the state's greater goal of integrating this region, colonizing it, and making it a generic part of a modern China.
And what are some specific strategies that the Chinese government is implementing, some assimilation strategies to achieve this goal of, you know, integrating the Uyghur land or Uyghur communities into larger China?
Well, the policies are very extreme and they're not unprecedented in history. We've seen them before. But they're certainly unprecedented in the 21st century, and they benefit from the technologies of the 21st century. So we started to see already in 2016, as I mentioned earlier, that as the Chinese government was starting to target all Uyghurs as a potential threat, the government implemented technological surveillance using artificial intelligence, using video tracking, all kinds of new technologies for surveilling and scrutinizing the Uyghur population. And then in 2017, we started to realize that the state had built large internment camps all over the Uyghur region and was essentially arbitrarily interning large swaths of the Uyghur population in these camps. Now, inside these camps, the Chinese government initially suggested that they were not building camps and they had not interned Uyghurs arbitrarily. But soon the state stepped back from that argument because there was just too much evidence. Lots of people were able to point to satellite imagery. The Chinese state itself had put out public procurements to build these mass internment camps. And so then once the People's Republic of China realized that it could not deny the existence of these camps, they suggested that they were vocational training centers. And that is certainly not very accurate in the sense of what we would consider a vocational educational institution. These were essentially prison-like structures, and they did incorporate a lot of education per se, but really forced propaganda consumption by those who were interned. So a significant part of the day was spent on forcing Uyghurs to study the Chinese language. Those who were interned were not allowed to speak their own language. They were constantly surveilled to make sure that they complied with all these regulations. And then usually the second half of the day would be dedicated to consuming propaganda items about the Chinese state, and in particular about Xi Jinping thought and the ideology of the Chinese government. And a large degree that was also about disavowing Islam, disavowing any sense of Uyghur identity, excuse me, and also disavowing any idea of a Uyghur, of Uyghur self-determination in their homeland. So it's very much about a discourse of anti-extremism, where the Chinese government essentially portrayed any kind of religious observation not supported by the state to be extremist. And the arbitrariness of the detention was also really important. Evidence came to light early on that the Chinese government had given quotas to local governments to intern a certain percentage of the population, which meant that they would determine what was extremist behavior by the percentage they had to intern. And this led to almost comical excuses for why people were interned. They had a Quran at home. They had been to mosque 2 years prior. They had traveled to another country, particularly a Muslim country. They had communicated on social media something that was critical of the state, and so on. So that internment system and the surveillance system has served as what I would call the centerpiece of a complex of policies that have focused on destroying Uyghur identity and stripping the Uyghur homeland of any signs of Uyghur identity. So, under the threat, constant threat of internment and constant surveillance, Uyghurs cannot resist any of the measures the state is taking to promote inter-ethnic marriage, to promote residential labor programs, which is taking Uyghurs out of their native villages and putting them in residential factory sites, forced residential schools, which is something that, is a hallmark of settler colonialism. We saw it definitely in the Americas, where Native Americans were forced to send their children to residential schools where they were brought up speaking English and, learning either the American or Canadian idea of a civic culture. I think that all of these policies have been they started in 2017, but they continue, and they continue to break down any sense of Uyghur social capital, and also have served to displace a significant portion of the Uyghur population from their native towns and allowed the Chinese government to go in and resettle those areas and also develop them through new construction that doesn't have any of the hallmarks of Uyghur culture connected to it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, one thing that I found so striking is that, as you tell us in the book, many of the people who work in these camps are Uyghurs themselves, or they're from other indigenous Muslim groups. How does this work?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it, to go back to this notion of a complex of policies at the center of which is this mass internment center system, I think that just creates a sense of complete fear that, you know, makes the entire Uyghur population either compliant or interned or incarcerated, right? So I think that for many of the people who work in these camps, and there have been many who have since found ways to flee China and have talked about their experiences and were very critical of what was happening in the camps, you know, they view working in the camp as one of the only ways to avoid being interned in the camp. You know, and this is also, I think, a very typical phenomenon in settler colonial situations. You know, we've seen throughout history where colonial powers have to essentially harness the power of the local population to repress the local population. I think that one of the unfortunate black holes of information about what's happening is that it's almost impossible to, at this point, talk to anybody inside China who's either working in one of these camps or who has been in one of these camps. And the only environment in which you might be able to do that is on a media tour sponsored by the Chinese government, where the people you're talking to are basically reading from a script. And it's very difficult to get information about what people are actually experiencing on the ground in the Uyghur homeland right now.
I found your discussion of the self-fulfilling prophecies to be very useful in understanding the violent responses in defense to China's violent policies against the Uyghurs. Can you tell our audience what a self-fulfilling prophecy is and how it might explain or perhaps contextualize the Uyghur responses to what is happening there?
Yes, So I took that concept from Robert Merton, who was a sociologist in the U.S. in the 1940s and 50s. And, you know, although it's a theory from long ago, I think that it is useful in a lot of ways, particularly in terms of looking at the Uyghur situation. Merton used this this concept as a way to describe how structural racism became self-perpetuating in various contexts. So, you know, he would talk about how racism towards African Americans in the U.S. led to stereotypes that African Americans weren't interested in education, which translated into less financing for African Americans' education, which translated into lower levels of education for African Americans. And it became this kind of cycle. And I think one of the important points that Merton makes is that the power of the self-fulfilling prophecy, which has its origins almost always in stereotypes and in racist concepts, is that it creates a situation where the stereotype that you have created for this population essentially begins to look true. And then you can point to it and say, well, this is why we have been doing this all along. So in terms of the Uyghurs, there's long been stereotypes about Uyghurs being lazy, Uyghurs being potentially violent, you know, hallmarks of racist ideas about the other from many colonial situations. In addition to that, when you overlaid the concept of them being a terrorist threat, I think that created a situation where the Chinese government increasingly targeted all Uyghurs as potentially dangerous. And this put a lot of pressure on the population. There was increased policing of the population, increased surveillance, and so on. And this was happening at a time where there was also promoting Han in migration to the region. So in 2009, all of this pressure led to violent ethnic conflicts in the city of Urumqi, which is the capital city of the Uyghur region in China. And that only further amplified kind of the Chinese state, and I think even a lot of the Han public in China, their perspective on Uyghurs as being a danger, a threat. And the government increasingly cracked down on Uyghurs after these ethnic riots. In particular, in Uyghur rural communities, created something of martial law where Uyghurs were constantly under surveillance and were being harassed by the police. And this led to outbursts of violence, you know, which is not surprising. And that violence then further motivated the violence of the state. And you had this kind of self-perpetuating cycle of repression, violent resistance, more repression, more violent resistance. And eventually in 2013, 2014, that led to a couple instances in the Uyghur region and outside the Uyghur region where Uyghurs allegedly perpetrated acts of violence that I would consider to be terrorist in character. There's only a handful of them, but these have been hallmarks of the Chinese government's ability to say, look, this is a threat. This happened in 2014. This was a grave terrorist attack. This proves that Uyghurs are a terrorist threat. I think that self-fulfilling prophecy of targeting a group as as a terrorist threat is inevitably going to lead to that group taking up violent resistance, and then the source of being labeled a terrorist threat points to that violent resistance to say, yes, see, they always have been a terrorist threat.
I want to make sure that we also spend a little time to listen to Uyghur voices on this crisis. You address some of this at times throughout the book. Can you tell us about some of your experiences with the Uyghur population, with individuals you've met, maybe folks you've talked to who've escaped these camps or otherwise just managed to successfully leave, at least physically, to survive the journey?
Yeah, so there's one of the things that happened in the Uyghur region as the situation became more disruptive, I would say starting with 2009, is you had a significant number of Uyghurs fleeing China. Some of them legally, some of them illegally. A significant number of them ended up in Turkey. And a lot have also ended up in Europe and in the United States. And then the other thing that happened was after 2017, as they started to arbitrarily intern Uyghurs inside China, Uyghurs with family members abroad told those family members to stop contacting them because they thought that would be dangerous, because they knew that one of the excuses to intern somebody was if they were communicating with family members abroad. So one of the things that I've noticed, you know, I've been studying Uyghurs for about 30 years, and I've communicated a lot with the diaspora communities, and in particular some of those who've been politically active. But after 2017, almost the entire Uyghur diaspora became politically active, because even people who whose family members might be in the Communist Party, but were still being interned in these mass internment camps, they started to speak up. And so you really have a cacophony of Uyghur voices now talking about the situation. And there's also been some who have escaped, mostly via Kazakhstan. And some of them Uyghurs and some of them ethnic Kazakhs. And all of these people have talked to international journalists and given their accounts of what happened in the camps. One of the things that I guess I found in my research is that the Uyghur people, to some degree, they've always been transnationalized. They've always had kind of a variety of cycles of out-migration. First, during the revolution in the late 1940s, early 1950s, you had a lot flee China. You had some flee during the Cultural Revolution. You had a significant number flee to the Soviet Union, and in particular, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And you had some who ended up in Turkey. And since 2009, as I mentioned, Turkey has become the largest destination for Uyghur refugees, essentially. So when I was writing the book, I spent a significant amount of time in Turkey speaking to Uyghurs, Uyghurs who'd fled, who were able to tell me about the situation leading up to this major crackdown. And I also was able to interview some of the Uyghurs who had joined militant groups in Syria to find out about the groups there and how they've kind of evolved and what the people fighting for these groups really think they're doing. So there's I think in terms of my own research in this book, the discussions with Uyghurs who'd been in Syria is one of the particularly new items or new information that the book is bringing to light, and how these militant groups in Syria have developed that have significant numbers of Uyghurs connected to them.
Occasionally throughout the book, you share some very insightful anecdotes about your experience doing this research or writing about the Uyghurs. I was wondering if you might be open to sharing some of these experiences here with us, with our audience, because I think that they speak to the various kinds of consequences of doing research on doing research in which you complicate or challenge dominant narratives, such as what I think is Chinese propaganda against Uyghurs and, or, you know, China's idea of the People's War on Terror.
Mm-hmm.
So could you, if you're open to it, I would love to hear more about some of your experiences, the ways in which the average Chinese person or netizens, I guess, in the case when you write articles online and Chinese people respond to them, any anecdotes you can share with us in doing this research?
Sure. I mean, one that I talk about in the book is, was in 2013, when the first act of violence that looked something like a terrorist act carried out by a Uyghur in China occurred. And this was a family of Uyghurs that drove a SUV into Tiananmen Square. And there was very little damage done in this act. And it remains unclear what the people were trying to accomplish. That said, it created a lot of anxiety inside China, because this happened in Beijing at the Tiananmen Square, which is kind of the symbolic place of the power of the Chinese state. It looked more like a terrorist act that had been in the news, say in Europe, where you'd have people drive a truck through a public gathering or something. And CNN.com asked me to write an opinion piece about it. And in the opinion piece, I noted that it was very difficult to know what the people were trying to accomplish in this, but that it made less sense to look at it as an organized, premeditated terrorist attack with any sort of organization behind it, and much more useful to look at it in terms of basically an outburst of outrage. Given the tensions that Uyghurs were under at the time in their homeland, you could see why somebody might do something like this, even somewhat spontaneously. That created a significant uproar on the internet. I got personally a lot of death threats from Chinese netizens, both inside China and outside China. And there was a campaign inside China to actually kick CNN out of the country, because the Chinese government blamed CNN for my opinion piece. That was a very uncomfortable moment, I would say, because it also crossed this this line about being critical of any accusations of terrorism. And I think that since 9/11, people, at least in the United States, but I think elsewhere in the world too, have felt very reticent to question accusations of terrorism because it's seen as this existential threat, and you don't want to be seen as being on the side of the terrorists. And this is, you know, in some ways one of the real powers of the global war on terror, that it's created this, you know, I think unconscious self-censorship in people to not talk about something like that. And, you know, there, of course, there's been sure a lot of scholars who've written critical things about the global war on terror, but it's been seen largely as an academic issue and not in the public domain. And then, you know, a similar experience I've had is over, while I was writing the book, I served as an expert witness in Norway for a case where a Uyghur who had been in Syria was arrested by the Norwegian government on terrorism charges. And it was a very interesting experience. I both testified at the original trial and then at the appeal trial. And it was very discouraging because my counterpart, who was basically a terrorism expert, had these very preconceived notions of what constitutes terrorism and what doesn't. And I was trying to really question those things, but I found also that the court itself, you know, was much more caught in these classic ideas. It's, well, it's not what the person did. It's about whether they had connections to a specific group and whether this specific group believes in Salafism. And that should constitute a terrorist, you know. So anybody who is involved in any sort of violence, political violence, who is inspired by Salafism is seen as a terrorist. And you know, I found it to be, I think one of the moments I got most flustered was the first court date. The defense, or I guess, no, the prosecutor for the state accosted me and accused me of being sympathetic to the Uyghurs and that I could not be objective because of my sympathy for these people, which I found to be an absurd accusation. You know, as an anthropologist, I think that anthropologists believe that you should have a strong sense of empathy with the people that you're studying. Being accused that, you know, just the fact that I lived with Uyghurs when I was doing field work, that should constitute a lack of objectivity, you know, was infuriating to me. But, you know, I think that those are some of the things that people face as an uphill battle if they're dealing with dominant narratives, and particularly one like the global war on terror, which has become so ingrained in our society.
And as we approach our close here, in the conclusion, you address some important questions about the future trajectory of this tragedy. And I would especially like to ask about what we can do, whether as individual, as ordinary people, or as decision makers, people with positions of power, to prevent this from escalating and worse.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the most difficult things to kind of formulate, is how to deal with a mass atrocity like this, you know, or something that essentially is a pending genocide. On the one hand, if we look historically, the international community has proven itself incapable of preventing genocides. You know, I can't think of one that was really prevented by international action. But I also don't think that means that people should stop trying. I think it's really important. And I think we live in a different world now where there are some ways to really push back and try to make the Chinese government change its behavior. I don't think that's going to come from states alone. I think states can play a part in it. But unfortunately, right now, we see the United States taking a lead role in pushing back on China. And the response from the Chinese government is that this is just the U.S. Worried about a rising China and a declining American hegemony around the world. And that's an appealing argument to a lot of people, particularly in the developing world. And the Chinese state will say, well, you know, this whole narrative about cultural genocide in the Uyghur region is made up by the American government. And we're finding that a lot of people who don't believe the U.S. government usually are very prone to that argument. So right now, with the Trump administration kind of taking the lead, I almost worry that that's going to backfire. And that's, you know, only going to make it harder to change China's behavior on this. One of the things that I talk about in my book, and I've been talking about in various venues, is that I think it's really important to see a grassroots movement and a global grassroots movement that really tries to hold the Chinese state accountable for what it's doing to Uyghurs. And I think that the main fulcrum for that is related to consumer advocacy, because in the world right now, almost all consumer products, you know, are not all of them, but, you know, an incredible percentage of them are made in China. And all of us are consuming Chinese products constantly. And what we're seeing is that what the situation of the Uyghurs is becoming entangled in all of the supply chains of global brands around the world. So, for example, the majority of cotton that we see being developed into clothing around the world, a significant percentage of it is coming from the Uyghur region of China. A significant percentage of processed tomatoes in the United States comes from the Uyghur region of China. And through these forced residential labor programs that Uyghurs are being subjected to, we're seeing that Uyghurs are working in factories all over China that are completely entangled in significant global supply chains. So good research that can really point to the products that are being made and sold globally that are entangled and complicit with what's happening to the Uyghurs. And on top of that, advocacy in terms of boycotting those products or divesting from the companies that are producing those products, I think could really have an impact. Now, of course, I think eventually we're going to have to also see a lot of states that have not yet spoken up about what's happening to Uyghurs speak up about it. And this is in particular true of the Muslim world, which has been noticeably silent about what's happening to Uyghurs inside China.
Thank you so much for this. Then as we close, could you tell us about any current or future research that you're working on? No pressure. What are you working on now that we can look forward to reading in the near future, hopefully?
I actually am working on a book that builds on this concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy, and is looking at the Uyghur example, as well as two other examples from Eurasia, the Chechens and the Uzbeks, who have where we've seen different forms of local political activism be essentially stopped or completely eliminated, and leading to people joining militant terrorist groups connected to, you know, global terrorist networks around the world. So, you know, trying to look at the same methodology I did in terms of examining the Uyghur issue, and looking at it in the case of how we've seen a proliferation of Chechens and Uzbeks involved in international terrorist networks as well. And really, you know, trying to show how the global war on terror has morphed throughout the world, where we have a variety of states using this discourse as a means to suppress domestic dissent, and that is essentially fueling the recruitment of terrorist organizations around the world. So it's a related project, but it's also comparative in nature, because I want to make the point that I make in this book about the war on terror a little more forcefully by bringing out that this is not just an isolated case in the case of the Uyghurs, but this is a problem that is endemic to this whole concept of a global war on terror. And at the root of that problem is the fact that the international community refuses to come up with a consensus definition of what is terrorism.
That sounds very important and relevant. I look forward to it. Thank you so much, Sean, for joining me today. And I look forward to your future research as well.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, so that was my interview with Sean Roberts about his book, The War on the Uyghurs, China's Internal Campaign Against a Muslim Minority, published with Princeton University Press in 2020. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you again soon.